This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Shartok of the State University.
In this edition of the Legislative Gazette, we'll meet one of the newest members of Governor Cuomo's inner circle, Counsel Evan Davis. Also, some thoughts on the meaning of this week's local election. The subject of wage equity in state jobs continues to stir considerable interest, not only among those who hold those jobs, but within the state administration, public employee unions, and advocacy groups. Leslie Brokaw has a report on new studies of the wage issue.
The studies by the Center for Women in Government and Arthur Young and Company were commissioned as a result of a collective bargaining agreement between the state and its employees' unions. That in itself makes the studies unique, since many that are undertaken around the country are done so because of court cases. Both studies were released on Thursday, and the results, while not necessarily surprising, are far-reaching. At least 50,000 and as many as 80,000 women and minority men were deemed to be performing jobs that, based on their responsibilities, amount of stress, and overall effort, should be paying more. Once the state evaluates and implements the results of the studies, thousands of state employees will be receiving anywhere from several hundred to several thousand dollars a year more. State Director of Employee Relations, Thomas Hartnett.
As the implementation team looks at the priorities and how we're going to approach payments for various individuals, we may agree with some and we may not agree with others, and that's part of the process of shaking all this out. I would say with a high degree of confidence that people can, in undervalued titles, generally will start to see some additional compensation in the second year of this agreement.
The money to implement the program was set aside in the last collective bargaining session. 1% has given a pool of about $74 million. Again, Employee Relations Director Thomas Hartnett.
We're confident that the amount of money that was set aside in the negotiations, and we were in the collective bargaining several months ago and talked about this issue, recognizing fully that you have a certain amount of money to negotiate a contract. State has its priorities, like we talked about health insurance and various other issues. And one of those priorities was that we wanted to come out of this round of negotiations with some money set aside to implement the findings in these studies. We did that with the Civil Service Employees Association, with the Public Employee Federation, and in the pay bill that we put in for the non-represented management confidential employees. We are confident that the money set aside is going to substantially address the issues that have been handed out in both of these reports.
The study by the Center for Women in Government focused on the specific issue of comparable worth. All the state jobs were basically evaluated to determine, for example, how much jobs dominated by white males paid for specific job characteristics. Did the males' jobs pay more for higher education, for greater employee relations? Did they take into account more stressful working conditions? Using those results as a base, the researchers then looked at jobs dominated by women and minorities. They found that most of those jobs did not pay as much for comparable levels of stress and responsibility and education requirements. The study also found some jobs to be overvalued, that is, paid more than the state's criteria judged that they should be. The study did not focus on that issue, however, although Hartnett indicated that down the line, the salaries of those jobs would somehow be brought into line with the others. A second study by Arthur Young and Company looked at the overall state employee system, one that they found to be much too complicated and inefficient. Thomas Hartnett.
The study found that the current job classification system will not serve us well as we go into the next century. It recommends a thorough overhaul or replacement, including a reduction of the more than 7,000 titles that exist in the present system.
The Comparable Worth Study is one of the first in the nation to evaluate both the minority undervaluation alongside of the female undervaluation. It's also one of the first to be initiated through the combined efforts of state government and the unions. The study now goes to an implementation project team, which will develop and put into place a new pay structure that will address the problems of pay equity. This phase is expected to take several months. I'm Leslie Brokaw.
This has been a year of high-level changes within the Cuomo administration. One of the most significant changes was the one which saw the governor's secretary, Michael Del Judas, leave for a position in private business. His place was taken by former counsel Gerald Crotty. Today, we'll talk with a man who took Crotty's old job, governor's counsel Evan Davis.
Let me ask you this question first. Which job is harder, being a litigator for a major Wall Street firm or being the governor's counselor?
Well, in terms of the hours, this job is much harder. It's a very, very busy day. A lot of midnight oil gets burned on this kind of job. In terms of the intellectual challenge, this job is as great an intellectual challenge as you could find. Every issue from A to Z. You got to learn the history of the issue. You got to learn the substance. You got to do everything. I say this job is a lot harder.
Let's talk about an issue for a moment. Medical malpractice. You walk into this hotbed. I've sat around this table with Jerry Crotty discussing this in the past. The doctors on one side, the lawyers who you just talked about on the other side. First of all, let me ask you this. In the critical conflict, in this mass between doctors and lawyers who seem to be fighting it out on either side of this issue, do you see yourself in any conflict of interest as a lawyer?
Not at all, because I don't see the issue as one between doctors and lawyers when you get down to the real problem. Sure, the doctors and lawyers are angry at one another. The lawyers see the tremendous incidents of malpractice that occur, which are tragic and devastating, and there is malpractice, and it's a real problem. And obviously, it's a number one thing to prevent malpractice. And the doctors see cases that they think go on for too long and where the results aren't really accurate and where they feel they're being imposed upon by overly aggressive lawyers. So it gets emotional. I think what you have to do is you have to get beyond emotion and look at what the problem is. And when you do that, you see that there is a problem. It takes 7 years in this state to resolve a malpractice claim in the courts, and that doesn't count the appeals. 7 years when people don't have any compensation, don't have the award they need in a case of malpractice to pay their medical bills and have the extra services and help they need as a result of the malpractice. 7 years is much too long. I think we're not doing enough to discipline doctors, to get the bad doctors out of the system. The doctors want the bad doctors out, just as the lawyers always want the bad lawyers out. No one who's a good doctor or a good lawyer feels that the people who aren't do anything for the profession. And we have now a rather cumbersome system in New York for discipline. First it goes to the Department of Health, and then it goes to the Board of Regents, and it's a two-step process, and it's long, and it's involved. It's important to improve that process. It's important to attack the 7-year time period. A part of the problem is that good doctors are afraid to take on a high-risk case. Because a high-risk case, you know, something could go wrong. It's in the nature of it being a high-risk case. And we don't want a situation where people who have a high-risk medical problem are not going to get the best medical care. We have a problem of defensive medicine, where out of over-concern, people are being having to take pills or go through procedures or spend extra time and money that is not needed. And that's also part of the problem. And, of course, who pays the bill for these problems in the end? Well, I think it's the consumers of medical services, the taxpayers, the doctors themselves. It's not a matter of trying to help a particular profession like a doctor or trying to hurt a particular profession like a lawyer. Everyone has an interest in seeing that these problems are solved.
Now, if I can just cut in for a second, we are all waiting, of course, on a major session of the legislature, a special session. Primarily, I am told, that one of its major tasks is going to be to try to come to some kind of resolution on this malpractice. The governor said was said to have promised the doctors that he would work on that, on some kind of solution before the beginning of the next session, and we're waiting to see if one comes up. And we're hearing right now there may be one, there may not be one, from different sources. Well, clearly, you're the point man on malpractice. You're the guy who sort of has to put this thing together. You get thrown into this new from New York. You have Warren Anderson, who's been here what seems like years and years, Stanley Fink, a man of the legislature, the speaker, all with hotshot troubleshooters in this area, and you're supposed to carry the ball. Isn't that a little frightening?
Well, it's certainly a challenge. The people who've been working on the malpractice problem in the legislature, in this office, are all extremely able and have given it a tremendous amount of thought. And one thing that makes the challenge easier is an openness to learn from them. I think that the way we're proceeding, where we're sitting down and working on the problem and addressing it in a serious way, as you know, the stage we're at now is we've circulated a draft to legislative council and are talking with them. And the fact that they're very knowledgeable on the area and spent a lot of time working on it is very helpful. I have to do a quick study to come up to speed on the issues and be able to have the same knowledge that they have.
But, of course, that's what a Wall Street lawyer has to do all the time.
Well, I've had to do that over the years, that's right, and I've certainly been burning the midnight oil, as I said earlier, doing the quick study.
Now, when one of the things that the governor has sometimes been criticized by some is such as reported by my friend Fred Dicker, it has been that, in fact, he doesn't take the lead on some of these legislative initiatives. He lets the legislative leaders work it out for themselves and stamps his imprimatur on that. That's the allegation. I present it to you in the context of this case study that we're looking at right now. What say you?
I think an effort to work with the various groups, and we go also beyond the legislature. We have, in any kind of legislative matter, there are people whose interests are at stake, and they have to be consulted with and worked with. I've certainly been trying to make sure that the problem is addressed and that a sound solution is put forward, and I think that we here in the office, so far as I've seen in the 2 months I've been working on it, do take the lead in the right kind of way. Not in a dictating way, not in a bull in the china shop kind of way, but trying to make the political process effective and work and open so that all affected have a chance to participate, and the legislature has a very important role and it can't be ignored. The governor has a role of leadership, and I think that we are exercising it, but trying to do it in an open way.
Does he throw, I mean, this phone that I'm looking at over here on your desk becomes famous in that he calls people up early in the morning, late at night. He's a workaholic. How much initiative does he take? How much hands-on do you find him having as a boss? Does he call you up and say, Evan, I think one of the things we ought to do is cut down on the amount of time that the doctors have to put up with a malpractice case with, or that the lawyers it takes to get through the courts? Is that the kind of initiative you're bound to hear on him, or does he say to you, look, this is your baby, you handle it?
One of the things that really keeps me on my toes is the governor is very well informed on all the questions, is thinking about them all the time, and is always challenging me. I've on several occasions sat down to talk with him on an issue that I had thought through and thought I was really well prepared on, and he was really several steps ahead of me. He really keeps you on your toes.
Okay, now, the governor has this mythical special counsel, Fabian Palomino, who many people hear about, but few people really see. And the governor is forever lecturing us, and me in particular, on the fact that Mr. Palomino is a lawyer's lawyer. You walk into this as his lawyer, as the head of the legal staff, or what Jerry Crotty used to call a little law firm here on the second floor. Do you find that Palomino interferes, that he helps, or that he's not really a player?
Very helpful. Fabian and I work closely together. Fabian does more special project kind of stuff, but he's been very helpful to me, and we work very well together.
Our listeners certainly want to know about Evan Davis, the man. Okay, what's the most profound thing that has happened in your life in terms of affecting the way in which you think you approach life? Is it your family? Is there something that you could point to as saying as really having provided for some kind of map, cognitive map in your head in the way you approach things?
I think for me, it's probably like for most of us, it's my education. And that's, of course, a product of a lot of teachers and a lot of books over a long period of time. And we all come away from that process with particular ideas that have sort of stuck in our mind through what the teachers said and through the books we read. And it's the same for me. It's mainly my education that...
Where did you go to school?
I went to public schools in Greenwich, Connecticut through the ninth grade. I then went to a school called Exeter in New Hampshire for 3 years, which is a very good school. I then went to Harvard College, and I finally went to Columbia Law School. And then I had on-the-job education with Judge Leventhal on the D.C. Circuit, who was a great judge. Unfortunately, he died a few years ago, but just a marvelous judge. And Justice Stewart on the Supreme Court, another fantastic judge, a man whose mind was totally non-prejudiced, totally open to the realities of a problem. Mind is still open. He's retired now as a judge, but he was that was a wonderful experience, too, and to have the opportunity to be on the court and to see that such an important process working and the integrity of it was really unique. Then I worked for the city of New York for a while. I was head of the Consumer Protection Division in the Law Department, and also did some work in the Budget Bureau, and then I worked on the impeachment inquiry, working for John Doerr, who was the lead counsel for the House Judiciary Committee.
Your eyes light up when you talk about judges. Do you want to be a judge?
Judging is one of the important roles in society. It has its important. They try to bring reason and logic to problems. They follow precedent. They build on the wisdom of those who've gone before. They try to write opinions that explain clearly to the bar and the public the reason for the decision. It's a very noble, and it's an exciting, important thing. Judges lead a somewhat isolated life. They cannot have as much the normal contact because they're a little bit removed, and to preserve their independence, they have to do that. So in the job I have now, which is so much in the middle of the hustle-bustle of government, if you became a judge, you would lose that. It's much more removed. I don't know. You just have to... let life go on and see what it brings to you.
Wouldn't it be ironic if someday there were one place on the New York State Court of Appeals and you and Mario Cuomo were competing for it?
Well, that would be ironic. That would be ironic.
I'll get out of here with the proviso that you promised that you'll come back and talk to us on the Legislative Gazette again.
I would love to do that. Thank you very much.
Now let's hear from regular contributor Dr. Lee Marengoff. He's the director of the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion in Poughkeepsie.
This week's election day was far more dramatic in other states than in New York. Although New York voters selected local mayors in major cities throughout the state, the neighboring state of New Jersey selected its governor. With New York's gubernatorial contest now just 1 year away, what insights for our politics can be drawn from Tom Kaine's smashing re-election victory in New Jersey? Governor Kaine, a Republican, went into the election a strong favorite. Popularity polls in New Jersey measured his rating at close to 70%. Although Democrat Peter Shapiro ran a good campaign, he was outspent in the campaign and outnumbered in the voting booth. Kaine's final tally on Election Day, interestingly, was almost identical to the approval rating he took into the campaign. For a potential Republican candidate, deciding whether or not to oppose New York's Governor Mario Cuomo next year, this pattern of voters endorsing a popular incumbent must be somewhat sobering. The closeness of an incumbent's final vote to his popularity rating during the campaign is a pattern that GOP well-wishers would like to break in New York. And certainly there are no guarantees that Cuomo's popularity will remain high or that voters will make his reelection effort a referendum on his administration. But his popularity is also close to 70%, and if the election boils down to a test of his incumbency, then his approval rating, which he enjoys, will be a good barometer of how that race does shape up. In addition to this, analysts must also ponder the political landscape to see who Cuomo's likely opponent will be. State Senator Roy Goodman has been touring the state, but has yet to demonstrate strong statewide appeal. Lou Lerman, who narrowly lost to Cuomo in 1982, is said to be contemplating a rematch, but according to recent New York Daily News reports, is reluctant to enter the race. Other names include Andy O'Rourke, Westchester County Executive. O'Rourke won re-election on Tuesday handily and would at least bring some suburban strength to the GOP ticket. As Marist College polls have shown, Cuomo is unusually strong in the suburbs surrounding New York City, and the Republicans certainly need to recapture those voters to have a hope of defeating Cuomo next year. Other names of potential candidates will surface in the months ahead. Tuesday's results in neighboring New Jersey suggest that with the economy in the state that it is, an incumbent governor who enjoys wide popularity going into a re-election campaign is certainly capable of record-breaking tallies. Whether or not New York follows the same pattern next year remains to be seen. In the meantime, for the Legislative Gazette, this is Lee Meringoff at the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion in Poughkeepsie.
Now we come to that regular segment of the show where Bill Gralty, the producer of the Legislative Gazette, and I get a chance to kick around some of the events of the last week. Welcome, Bill.
Well, Alan, this was an election week, a local election primarily. We last week went over the five ballot questions in New York. But I'm interested in some of your thoughts as a political scientist. If you read any tea leaves in elections in New York State and even elsewhere, a Republican winning in New Jersey, a Democrat winning in Virginia. What's it kind of mean for the Republican and Democratic parties, do you think?
I really think it means very little, except that political parties have to force themselves to rethink some of the very basic premises that they have. We find a number of truths in politics. For example, a lot of people didn't come out and vote this time. We see that, in fact, it declines and declines and declines, particularly where there is not a significant race. Where you get a good hot race, everybody comes out to vote.
So we might look at, say, Syracuse and Buffalo, for example, where there were close races for mayor.
Right.
In those two cities.
Of course, in Buffalo, we saw the mayor, the incumbent, and we've said so many times on this show, incumbency counts for an awful lot, who was a Democrat and who is now a Republican. Mm-hmm. He has always been a nemesis of Mario Cuomo. Mario Cuomo endorsed his opponent, who was a black man. However, Mayor Griffin won his seat again. So that has led some people to think that Cuomo's coattails are not all that extensive. However, the first person, for anybody who ever listens to the governor on this station, to say that coattails don't mean a damn thing is Governor Cuomo. I think what we saw in this election was not trends for either party, but really the fact that you have to think out your positions. In New Jersey, we saw Governor Kane win a tremendous victory over there. He was endorsed by no one less than Coretta Scott King, Martin Luther King's widow. He made a tremendous appeal for black votes as a Republican, where all kinds of other Republicans have been writing off the black voter. And indeed, he won a tremendous victory over there, which is going to be very hard for Mario Cuomo to replicate, even considering his great popularity in New York State. In Virginia, you had a lieutenant governor, a black man, winning for the first time in the history of that state since the Confederacy. An extraordinary thing. And a woman, for the first time as a Democrat, becoming the state attorney general. So what we're seeing is some new ideas being injected in. And
of course, if nothing else, this election that just passed is significant in that it marks 1 year to the day almost to the next major election. So a new season is in effect beginning along about now. That clock is ticking down to less than a year.
That's right. Mario Cuomo, of course, in a correct credit-claiming position, took some credit for the
job development authority bond issue going, well, not bond, but constitutional amendment, doing as well as it did extraordinarily well. Once again, he showed that he could get out there on the hustings and push. But, of course, so did virtually every other politician in the state. Yes, I think that we are going within 1 year. We see Mario Cuomo with a tremendous voter approval in the poll, probably of historic proportions. Things will start to warm up now.
Let me ask you one other political matter on politics, and that was news this week that Lou Lehrman has been talking to the chairman of the Republican Party, Anthony Colavita, about a possible rematch. What do you make of that? Is Mr. Lehrman serious, or is he just having a little fun talking and getting his name in the news?
Well, I think that the way things are now, he would have to not have the kind of appetite for it that he had a year ago. A year ago, clearly he knew he had a shot. I think now, barring some unforeseen circumstance, it would appear he would not have that good a chance. On the other hand, he made it an exciting race. He showed that he could spend an awful lot of money the last time. And in fact, we don't know what the White House has in mind for him. Let us say, for example, that the White House wants him to get involved in this race, is willing to give him something for, quote, dirtying Cuomo during this campaign and keeping his plurality down, thereby cutting him off for a potential presidential run. They may be worried about that. So there may be a lot more here than meets the eye. He may have reasons for doing this. But I would suspect that he has not really shown a tremendous eagerness to get into this race up to now. Maybe somebody will convince him that there's something that should be done here for reasons unbeknownst to us. That's our show for this week. Join us again next week for another look at state government and politics. Bill Guralty edits and produces this program. Leslie Brokaw is associate producer. Please address comments and questions to us at WAMC, Box 13,000, Albany, New York, 12212. I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University of New York College at New Paltz.